Welcome to the archives of The Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. And hello there, I'm Loralee, and thanks for tuning into Conversation for Exploration. Let me read you an article that I found most interesting. It showed up in the paper today. And this, again, is by Popular Mechanics and was written for the Associated Press Special Features. And it says, the miracles reported in the Bible may have a foundation in scientific fact. With the help of high-tech methods and archaeological research, Mike Fillon wrote in an article in the current issue of Popular Mechanics, so interesting that this shows up in magazines like that, that scientists are becoming convinced that there may be another dimension to these tales. Prior to that, said Steve Prothero at the Boston University American Religious History Department, what people were really working with were texts. Now, with some interesting finds, such as early church meeting places, they've really gotten into doing archaeological research to fill out their view of the early church and their understanding of the New Testament. Take, for instance, speculation that the Red Sea, mentioned in Exodus, is not the Red Sea, R-E-D, Red Sea, but the Reed Sea, R-E-E-D, Reed Sea. Because the original Hebrew phrase for Red Sea was Yam Suf, which means Reed Sea. And that best describes the lake region north of the Gulf of Suez. According to the account in Exodus of Moses' feet, that's F-E-A-T, his feet, enough water was present initially to block the fleeing Israelites and then later to drown the pursuing Egyptians. And some researchers now suggest that the biblical Red Sea is modern-day Lake Sirbonis. And according to a bulletin from the American Meteorological Society, computer calculations indicate that because of the peculiar geography of the northern end of the Red Sea, or this Reed Sea, a moderate wind blowing constantly for about 10 hours could have caused the sea to recede about a mile and the water level to drop 10 feet, leaving dry land for a time before crashing back, thus making that miracle possible. Isn't that interesting? And again, with those astronomical events that, in fact, could have been the star of Bethlehem, the Christmas star, well, there is a lot of interest in sleuthing archaeologically and astronomically, geologically, sleuthing the actual stories, evidence for these stories as given in the Bible. And we're going to hear about some more sleuthing tonight via archaeology and textual references. And this comes from Paul William Roberts. Now, he's been a great friend of many of the guests that we've had on this show, Rand Flemath, John Anthony West, Colin Wilson, Rick Levine, and many more. So I've heard about Paul William Roberts for a long, long time. In fact, I heard about him a lot when we were in Egypt with John Anthony West, because John would quote him often, and most significantly as being the first to conclude that many of the stone artifacts that we saw that cannot be reproduced today may in fact be remnants of an earlier age and perhaps were antiques to the ancient Egyptians back then. Paul William Roberts, let me tell you a little bit about him. He's British. He graduated from Exeter College in Oxford. He taught English literature at Oxford before he set off around the world. He spent a couple of years in India and then finally settled in Canada. He's won numerous awards for screenwriting and journalism. I finally caught up with Paul William Roberts during an interim in his world travels and found him home in Toronto. He is, as you'll discover, a very good storyteller, and he offers both the research that he goes on-site and into libraries to find, as well as a travelogue of his many adventures. And it doesn't take much to set him off on an adventure. One Christmas, he writes, he was given an early version of The Travels of Marco Polo, and this book had not been edited of the reference to the story of the Magi that Marco Polo heard and recounted in his book some 700 years ago. So the question remains, who were those Magi? Well, the Oxford English Dictionary offers this definition of Magi, quote, a member of the ancient Persian priestly caste, said by ancient historians to have been originally a Midian tribe. Hence, in a wider sense, one skilled in Oriental magic and astrology, and an ancient magician or sorcerer. And it then goes on to add, the Magi, the three wise men who came from the East, bearing offerings to the infant Christ. So, again, I found that reference in Paul's book, In Search of the Birth of Jesus, the real journey of the Magi. So, welcome, Paul.
Hello, Laura. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Well, I don't think my stuff's going to make it into Popular Mechanics, but I'd actually just like to add to that article you were reading. I mean, there's a big difference between what Rick's doing in providing the astrological explanation, in fact, the astronomical explanation too, and Popular Mechanics, you know, which are really trying to sort of debunk by finding and dredging the barrel for the slightest sort of conceivable thing. You know, like if the fishes turned, you know, the loaves and the fishes could have, you know, suddenly blown out of the sea. And but it's not quite the same thing. As there's a precedent to the story of the Red Sea, which goes back to some of the earliest of the Egyptian texts, when the sort of court magician to Khufu, Cheops, who built the Great Pyramid, supposedly, is trying to cheer his boss up and suggests that he takes a cruise on the lake because the pharaoh has the blues, and he feels a cruise on the lake will improve things. And during the cruise, one of his favorite wives loses her favorite piece of jewelry in the lake, and this all comes back to Chachaimunk, the magician, who now has to salvage the ring from the lake, and it specifically describes him parting the waters and sort of stacking them one, you know, on top of each other, side by side, which is very much similar to the description in the Bible of what Moses did. So since Moses does try to parallel all the feats of the pharaonic magicians and exceed them, this would have been something that he probably would have had to have done. So I think that, you know, there's another basis for it as well.
This stuff is becoming very mainstream now. The Royal Astronomical Society is now saying, hey, there were these astronomical events, and it could have been this conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn that became the Christmas star. I found that extraordinary. Rick told us that story years ago on the show. It's been going on for 7 years, and all these things that were at first fringe are now becoming so mainstream. To me, it's a sign that the paradigm shift is alive and well and progressing nicely.
And also that the scholarship has deepened and extended itself from the alternative end, if you like. I mean, in fact, if you read the New Testament in the original, I mean, all the people who say the Bible should be taken literally perhaps should, you know, learn the Greek and Hebrew in order to be able to take it literally. The two nativity tales in the two Gospels that have them, Matthew and Luke, I mean, I deal mostly with Matthew, and Matthew's the only one that recounts the tale of the Magi, but the terminology used there is specifically astrological in nature. In fact, you know, cannot be translated, you know, can't even be carried from the Greek to the Latin. And the Latin translation, the Vulgate, in fact, carries a, you know, kind of footnote to certain phrases, trying to explain them. But in the original Greek, on a couple of occasions, a couple of very significant occasions, the references are astronomical stroke, astrological in nature, and you can't ignore that.
Most interesting. Okay, tell us about how you began, and we'll just sit back and listen to some storytelling, and when you're done, we'll take some phone calls and spend the rest of tonight like that. Tell us how you were given the volume of Marco Polo's travels and how this initiated and began your journey in search of the birth of Jesus and who were the Magi.
Oh, well, okay. Are we sitting comfortably? I used to listen to a radio show in England, which began, it was when I was about five, and it would always begin, "Are we sitting comfortably? Then let us begin. Once upon a time." So once upon a time, not that long ago in Toronto, when the weather was about as cold as it is now, I was given a quite old copy of Marco Polo's Travels, 19th century copy. And I'd never read it, and always meant to read it, and always thought it would be the great classic of travelogues. And having sort of dabbled in that field, I felt the obligation to read it, and put aside a couple of days, the days after Christmas before New Year, when really nothing happens, and stretched back thinking I'm in for a big treat, and was really dismayed and amazed at how boring it was, and what a mercantile mentality Polo has, and sort of labored on with it, getting these descriptions of what you could buy in various places, and in entire countries dismissed as sort of fat or disagreeable. And then, I was about to put the book aside, and came upon the story that Polo tells when he's in a town called Sava, or Saba. It's either S-A-V-E-H or S-A-V-A or S-A-B-A, depending on where you're coming from. But he recounts being shown the tomb of the three kings who were at the nativity of Jesus, and tells of seeing their bodies embalmed. And they were still whole at that time, he says. He certainly describes their hair and their beards, and their clothes as still being intact. And then proceeds to recount the tale he's been told by the people who obviously showed him the tomb. And the story is partly like our nativity, or Matthew's nativity, and partly very, very different. So the kings travel to Bethlehem, but the gifts they have to give are quite clearly not so much gifts as tests, because it says that if the child took the gold, it would prove that he was to be a great earthly king. If the child took the frankincense, it would prove that he was destined to be a great divine king. And if he took the myrrh, it would show that he was destined to be the divine physician, which is a term often used in connection with Zoroaster, who was the great prophet of the Zoroastrian or Parsi religion. And so you have not the gifts that are mentioned quite clearly in Matthew, so much as items that are gifts as well as a test, and in fact quite similar to the test that is used to this day to determine if a child is the reincarnation of a great Rinpoche or Lama in the Buddhist religion. And there, I don't know whether people know, but the child who is selected by various methods is offered old possessions of the dead Rinpoche or Lama, and some new toys. And if he heads for the old possessions, then that's one sign. There are many others, but it specifically says in the tale Polo's told that these are tests. And
we'll come right back with Paul William Roberts, and he'll continue that tale and tell you many, many more as he recounts his adventures, his journey in search of the birth of Jesus. I'm Laura Lee. Hey, Laura Lee here, back on the Laura Lee Show. My guest is Paul William Roberts. He's telling us about the search for the birth of Jesus. He has that all written up in a wonderful combination travelogue and documentary. collection of his notes and research, and that book, In Search of the Birth of Jesus, The Real Journey of the Magi. You were telling us that in the story, as recounted by Marco Polo in his book on his travels, he recounts that the Magi showed up at Jesus' birth not just to give him gifts, but to really test him, to see his reaction to the various gifts. Could you finish that story, Paul?
Yeah, the gifts are quite clearly mentioned as a form of test. So when we're told that the three kings, Polo calls them, are three different ages, and when they reach the child, the baby's 13 days old, and we're told that each of the kings goes in separately first. And instead of seeing a child 13 days old, they see a person their own age. And then they come out, the last one comes out, and all three go in together, and they see a child 13 days old. And having told each other what they had experienced individually, they decide, obviously, to do away with the test and just give him all the three gifts. And the child can speak at 13 days old. And in fact, Jesus in the Quran, the Quran has quite considerable sections on Jesus, which are very interesting. In the Quran, he can speak from birth. So, you're obviously dealing with a tradition here. And he gives them a gift. Or instruct somebody to give them a gift, which is in a box, and they're instructed not to open it until they return to their own country, which they do. And on the way, obviously can't wait to see what they've got, and open the box, and in it find merely a stone, which disappoints them. And they fling the stone down a well, and immediately a torrent of fire descends from heaven, and they instantly realize that perhaps they misinterpreted the stone and are rather nervous about it, and then says that they then took some of the fire, meaning they obviously lit some wood from these flames and took it back to the temple in their own land where they worship it as a god, and if it ever goes out, they return to the well and replenish it. Now, what you have here, which is replete with mentions of, and Polo says many times, an unnatural number of times, that the story is true, and that people he refers to as those of the castle or the castle of the fire worshippers either told in the story, depending on the version you read, or confirm the story. Now, this tells us one thing, that whoever told him the story was not a Zoroastrian, because they would not have referred to themselves as fire worshippers. Zoroastrians do not worship fire. Fire or flame or light is used as a symbol, as it is in most religions.
But they do keep a flame, don't they?
Eternally. Yes, burning. I mean, yeah, but so do many religions. I mean, it's
the
in no way worship.
Yeah.
So presumably Polo was told this story by Muslims who had conquered Persia, Iran, by this time. Although there was a considerable population of Zoroastrians, in fact, there still is. But Polo at no point does he ever mention the religion. And in fact, he even passes through the major center of Zoroastrianism in Persia then and now without ever mentioning them. So we know he was entirely unaware of the religion, and that the story he relates must have been told him. And the version we get, although it has slight variance in the different manuscripts, and there are an extraordinary number of manuscripts of Polo's travels, but they really don't vary, although this particular story was, as you said, edited out in a number of versions because of its controversial nature. There are a number of other factors I'll get to that should have featured somewhere in Polo's account, but don't unusually. But I'll get to that in a minute. So I thought this is a really, in many ways, bizarre account of the Nativity, because part of it is what we recognize, and part of it is an attempt to fuse the beginnings of Christianity with the origins of Zoroastrianism, which is patently nonsensical because Zoroastrianism is much older. The dates I would give for the life of Zoroaster himself would be around 1000 BC. There's a lot of disagreement on this topic, but we'll get to that maybe. Either way, there's no question that Zoroastrianism began at the same time as Christianity, but the story is in some way an attempt to fuse the two for some reason, or a confused account, again, with the reason behind it. But it occurred to me after reading it that if one could find something resembling, or some remains of something resembling the tomb that Polo describes, and he describes it in considerable detail. And also, if there were nearby the remains of this castle he refers to as the Castle of the Fire Worshippers, that there would be even more reason to believe the story.
So, do we need to tell you that Paul William Roberts set out on this quest and found tomb in a castle that he thinks is very likely the very one that Marco Polo mentioned? We'll come back and you'll hear the rest of this story with Paul William Roberts in search of the birth of Jesus and who were the Magi. I'm Laura Lee.
Get ready for adventure, celebrating the free flow of new research that expands our worldview. It's radio that asks you to make up your own mind. Here's your host, Laura Lee.
And we are back. Hi, I'm Laura Lee. You're listening to The Laura Lee Show. We're talking with Paul William Roberts, author of a number of books. Right now we're talking about In Search of the Birth of Jesus, The Real Journey of the Magi. And Paul is recounting his research sparked by a reference in the works of the book of Marco Polo on his travels. And he tells me that Marco Polo mentioned a tomb and a castle of fire worshippers. And let's pick up the story where we left off. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, so I basically thought if I could get to Iran and get to the city of Saba, and could find some reason to believe that Polo's account was genuine. In other words, if there were the remains of a tomb, or even some sort of history of there being a tomb, such as he describes, and particularly the castle that he describes. He describes it as it being some distance from the city itself. There would be reason to believe the story, and that would in itself would be reason to try to recreate the journey from ancient Persia or modern Iran all the way to modern Israel and Bethlehem. And there was the idea for one journey, and of course you have to start applying for visas, and Iran is not exactly the easiest place to get to. I'm sure if you're American it's even more difficult, but nonetheless, I started persevering and eventually found some very helpful people at the United Nations mission, the Iranian mission to the United Nations, who realized that this was a bona fide kind of scholarly quest, and in the end were very helpful. But it gave me a lot of time to go on the second journey. There are really three journeys in the book. One is the physical journey. One is the really journey through the libraries or the research. And the other is more of an inner journey that really changed my feelings and my relationship towards Christianity, which was the faith that, you know, I was not so much brought up in as certainly surrounded by. Had never dismissed outright, but had never really considered as seriously as I think it probably deserves to be considered. You have all these three things in the book, but while I'm waiting for the physical journey to begin, the journey of research began. And the first thing I did was to read the Gospels in the New Testament. And it comes as quite a surprise to find that the story we all know, or think we all know, and in fact the story most people will tell you about the Nativity, doesn't really correspond to either of the two accounts. And that of the four Gospels, there are only two of them have a Nativity story. The other two really begin when the ministry of Jesus begins, when he's around 30 years old. So you have Matthew and Luke, who contain, whose Gospels contain a Nativity story, and the stories they tell are completely contradictory or completely different from each other in every single respect except two. They both agree on the virgin birth. And they both agree, by way of the genealogies that are offered, that Jesus, through his father Joseph, was a direct blood relative of King David, which was the condition, of course, for being the Messiah. Now, if you think about it, the two things they agree on are kind of mutually contradictory themselves. If there was a virgin birth, who cares who Joseph was related to? And Joseph figures prominently in the genealogies as the, because it's a patriarchal society, it matters who the father is related to, not the mother. We don't know who Mary was related to. So in the only two things that are agreed on, you know, there's disagreement. And then you have the two separate accounts, and this they're dated at least 10 years apart. Matthew's account essentially is dated by the death of King Herod, which we know historically took place in 4 BC. So the birth had to have taken place sometime, and quite, you know, probably quite a considerable time before that. In at least a couple of years. And the account in Luke's Gospel is dated quite clearly by the decree put out by Caesar Augustus via the governor of occupied Judea about taxation, which decreed that every family had to return to where the husband was born in order to enroll himself for taxation. And in Luke's Gospel, the Holy Family traveled from Nazareth to Bethlehem. The only problem with this is that Nazareth is a place that almost certainly did not exist until the 3rd century. And in the Gospel of Matthew, the family appear to live in Bethlehem and own a house there. There's no suggestion whatsoever that they're poor and can't afford an inn or there's no room. They have a house in Bethlehem. They appear to live in Bethlehem, and the child is born in the house.
Oh, not in the manger.
No, there's none of the manger. And it's curious that if you ask most people what the story is, you will get, in fact, a fusion of the two. It's usually called a conflation. but the term conflation implies that the two are precisely run together, except they can't be precisely run together. They have to be run together, dismissing facts or dismissing points in one or the other. And it's usually Matthew's gospel has prevailed, but the Reformation, for example, you know, during the Reformation in Germany, the Luke's gospel was much more popular because it's only in Luke's gospel that you get the shepherds being the first witnesses of the birth, and the shepherds are, obviously have much more kind of proletarian appeal than the kings do. But the first thing you realize on reading Matthew, particularly in the Greek, is that there aren't any kings at all. There are, the word is magoi. In fact, it's the only Persian word in all of the Greek of the New Testament, and it means quite specifically Zoroastrian priest, member of the Zoroastrian priestly caste, the Persian priestly caste, very similar to the Brahmins of India. There were a caste of people whose job it was to officiate religious functions, you know, which did not exclusively mean they had to be Zoroastrian functions. They could have been functions of other religions, because the priestly caste in those days was fairly broad-minded when it came to what exactly you believed, as long as you believed they should officiate. So,
very practical
you have,
people.
Yeah, and you, there's no, nowhere does it mention that there are three. It just essentially says some magi came from the east.
You've seen accounts where there were 14 priests, for example, and you've seen various numbers.
Yeah,
seen.
I mean, if you start looking, I mean, after I realized that nowhere did it say three, there are certainly three gifts, but nowhere does it say that there are three, and nowhere should it really be presumed. I mean, you know, if you think about it, there would have been a big fight over who was going to give the myrrh, because you know, nobody really seems to want the myrrh. And in fact, Monty Python's Life of Brian, which, you know, for all its sort of irreverent humor, is actually quite an accurate historical picture of, I think, Judea in that period. That when the three magi mistake Brian and his mother for Jesus, Brian's mother, having taken the gift, says, you know, come back any time, but, you know, forget the myrrh.
What was the problem with myrrh?
Well, I mean, for that, you know, who knows what it is? And, you know, in the film, she says, you know, what's myrrh? And they say it's a balm. She says, a balm? It's a kind of monster, isn't it? And she says, no, it's an ointment. No, I thought it was a monster. But in fact, you know, if you go into what myrrh is, you find that the Old Testament is fairly clear that myrrh is a sort of perfume, and a perfume cum ointment, you know, with some medicinal power, but it's definitely referred to for its sort of, you know, its function as not so much a cosmetic, but certainly you know, a perfume. In the New Testament, it's exclusively referred to as part of the pharmacopoeia. It's a medicine. And in fact, Jesus on the cross is offered wine mixed with myrrh as a narcotic. It's my belief that, in fact, myrrh corresponds to the Homa or Soma, which is part of the Vedic and part of the Zoroastrian religion, which is some kind of herb that was offered symbolically to the fire at the altar, but also consumed and seems to have had some sort of narcotic effects.
Interesting.
And it is a deep part of the religion. You know, whether you can go as far as to say that, you know, it was a psychedelic drug, I think is questionable. But
when we know that Egyptian mummies now have evidence of cocaine, which I'm assuming were coca leaves that they chewed to prevent thirst and hunger and to give them more energy. I mean, you could use that interpretation. I don't think they were distilling cocaine from it. And also remnants of nicotine in their tissue, in their hair. Then you have to assume that some of these narcotics and mind-altering substances were quite widespread, more so than we previously suspected. Just an interesting side note. We need to take a break. We'll come right back with Paul William Roberts and have him continue his journey in search of the birth of Jesus. I'm Laura Lee. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show, talking with Paul William Roberts. His book, one of many, In Search of the Birth of Jesus, The Real Journey of the Magi. And are we sitting comfortably? Let's continue. Go ahead, Paul.
It's great to hear an ad for Rand Flemeth. That's the good thing about this show, is that you get a bit of reality. I mean, that really is one of the most important books written this century.
And it is our mission to give researchers like you and he and others a space to give out their theories and their research in full.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, where was I? Myrrh.
Oh, the Homa, Soma, the Myrrh.
Yeah, I should sort of say that I don't want to give the impression that this is all heavyweight scholarship. I mean, the thing about heavyweight scholarship is that, you know, when I was going through university, I found most of the texts I had to read were really boring, and was determined after I turned my back on academia, you know, never ever to write that kind of book. And so I really, you know, try to entertain as much as possible, because, you know, why not? Where does it say it can't be amusing? I mean, you can learn more from most Shakespeare plays than you can from, you know, any 10 textbooks. But
well, you have a dry wit and an ironic sense of humor, and it's displayed beautifully in your books, and they're a very fun as well as fascinating read.
Well, you know, the book really is the sort of full account of. In fact, it's interesting when you finally come across biographies of these famous scholars, their own lives are in fact far more interesting than the stuff they wrote, and you kind of wish that, you know, they'd wrote about all these, you know, bizarre things that they were involved in. You know, just as you wish you really knew far more about Isaac Newton's involvement in alchemy. And wish that, you know, he really spent more time telling us exactly what that was, although he made it very clear to the Royal Society that he took it just as seriously as he took anything else.
And astrology, and I understand that those were the texts that haven't yet been translated, and there is a group that is going through and translating all his untranslated works that have to deal with the more esoteric parts of his research. So I think it was a choice of scholarship. Let's ignore this, but let's translate this.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't sort of subscribe to the notion that you know, things all went wrong. Everything that has happened is just fine. I mean, it was supposed to be, and I think that, you know, there's certainly been a long period of time where, you know, we've as a people, as a humanity, have been expected to develop other faculties, and just as the Atlanteans, by all accounts, had really overdeveloped the emotional, psychic faculties, we've buried those and now reached the point where we've overdeveloped the intellectual faculties, and the time has come to merge the two back together. Although, and when I set out to write this book about the birth of Jesus, I really saw it in far more simple terms. You know, what it eventually turned into was almost an alternative history of the last 2,000 years, if not the last 3,000 years. And it became an immensely difficult book to edit and put together, and credit for that really goes to Amy Hertz at Riverhead, who had that task. I wouldn't have wanted it. But as I began to look at all the components, the first component, of course, is what do the Gospels say? As I said before the break, you find that you don't find three kings, you find some magi. And in the Greek, you find these overtly astrological, astronomical references. For example, some magi came from the east. And the word for east in Greek, Anatolia, is the plural, means the east in general. And they saw their star in the east. The term used for east there is singular, ente anatole. It's actually an astronomical term, and it quite clearly tells us that their star was, if the star had been in the east for a star, they would have been facing the other way. They would have ended up in India, not Israel. So the star is in the eastern horizon, it's not related to the east geographically. And they follow the star by the time they reach, and it's only 12 verses. The whole story, which resonates throughout history, is really just 12 verses in the Gospel of Matthew. And by the time these magi reach Jerusalem, everybody seems to know why they're there. And Herod, and King Herod is a character all by himself. what I discovered eventually was that, and it's fairly obvious when you think about it, that all the historical information that we rely on for most of this stuff is really a product of Vatican-sanctioned scholars, and the Vatican, for a good sort of portion of its existence, was really the adjunct of the Holy Roman Empire. In other words, it was a political institution, and the popes were either in service to the emperors, or they were all the other way around. But as a religious institution, it doesn't really have much of a history, or certainly not much of one to be proud of. But when you realize that the history you're reading is sort of written, with a bit of a bias, you become inclined to take everything with a pinch of salt. And the main historical source for our knowledge of this period is the work of the Jewish historian Josephus, who, in fact, was writing for aristocratic Roman patrons who had a distinct dislike, is too mild. They actually hated King Herod, and they had good reason to hate him, and they also wanted to know every bad thing about him, which is why Josephus gives us a good three-page description of all the incredible encyclopedia of diseases that Herod suffered from. And when you read it, you think what kind of shape he must have been in when the Magi came to see him. I mean, just to give you an idea, he had hypertensive cerebral attacks that created a kind of reasonable facsimile of raving insanity. He had appalling stomach problems. He had was described as a kind of rot of the genitals, which resulted in worms of the genitals, suppurating feet, and so on. If he's a little sort of short-tempered, it's understandable. But when the Magi called in to this meeting, they only asked one question. All Herod ever says to them is, what time did your star appear? In English, it sounds a little sort of absurdly abrupt. But in the Greek, it's really much more illuminating, because the word for a period, phanestai, in Greek, means has a specific astronomical meaning. Refers to the chronicle rising, which is associated with the birth. So he's actually asking, is the heavenly body that has influenced your journey the same one my astrologers are telling me about? In other words, what precisely, what time did it rise above the horizon? In other words, what time does it indicate for the birth of the person you're trying to find?
Now, what month was this anyway?
I don't know whether the legend Rick told you about is the one I'm about to tell you about, but there is a legend which is virtually impossible to track down in terms of source, but that the legend states that the star would appear 2 years before the birth of the Messiah.
Or
the great sort of liberator. And that could account for the fact that Herod doesn't seem to see much urgency in following the Magi, because then he has to bring in the elders to ask where the Messiah is supposed to be born, which is almost humiliating when you think about it. He's king of the Jews, and he doesn't even know this one snippet of information, which would have been common knowledge to almost anyone who had any kind of Jewish education, that the Messiah, according to the Old Testament prophets, would be born in the town of David, which was Bethlehem. Herod doesn't even know that, and the fact that this is in there is an indication in itself what a lowly status he had. And Herod had enormous plans for a dynasty and a Jewish empire. The fact that he was placed there by the Romans didn't mean that he felt himself a slave of the Roman Empire. He had plans for an empire of his own, and the Jews themselves were far more influential than they're given credit for being. The resistance to the Romans was, in fact, far fiercer. We were given, certainly what I learned at school was that the Romans faced a mere rabble, who they easily sort of swatted like flies. And in fact, it was not the case. The resistance was really intense. And the Romans had never actually faced anything like it, nor had they come across anything quite like the religion that Judaism was then. And this notion of, an all-pervasive one God was, again, unique in their experience. And, all this will become evident a little later on when I talk about what actually was happening. But so the Magi go off to Bethlehem to find whatever they can find, and Herod sort of loosely agrees that they'll come back and tell him what they've found out. But there seems to be no urgency, and if Josephus is to be believed, Herod was certainly in no condition to go riding on a camel, even though it was only an hour's journey.
So
the Magi go off, and they then come eventually to the house where, it does not say stable. It merely says that there wasn't any room in the inn, and it says he was born in a manger. Well, the inn at the time would have been the caravanserai, which was divided into two levels. A caravanserai was a kind of trading, on the trade routes you would find one. They were fort-like structures where travelers, traders could rest, and were divided into two levels. The lower level would be stabling for animals, and also people who couldn't quite afford to go up to the upper level where the richer traders would spend the night. So, the inn and the stable are really the same thing, and there's no great indignity, and it's also not an indication of extreme poverty or hostility. And I'm sure the caravanserai were quite often filled up, but the child is encountered, and then in a dream, the magi are warned of God. It says specifically, in other words, God warns them that Herod has it in for the child, and the child is in danger. And sort of simultaneously, it seems, Joseph is warned, but by an angel of the Lord. And there's a bit of a distinction. The Magi get to talk to God, and Joseph gets informed by an angel. And angels are, in fact, one of the many Zoroastrian inventions or additions to our culture. So the end result is that the family take the child and flee to Egypt, where we're told they stay until Herod's death, when they're safe. And we're also informed that there was a slaughter of the innocents, that all children, all firstborn sons 2 years or under, are slaughtered. Now, Josephus, the historian, does not mention this incident, and since he mentions almost anything, in fact, absolutely anything, that reflects badly on Herod, there's a good reason to assume that there was no slaughter of innocents. But also, Jerusalem wasn't exactly Tokyo, and if the birth rate had been fairly low, perhaps there hadn't been any male children born in the last 2 years. It was a tiny little place. So this notion of the slaughter of the innocents is not quite what it seems to be. But they go off to Egypt and then appear to return when Herod is dead. And end of that nativity story. In Luke, of course, they just go back to, the shepherds come, and the shepherds are truly amazed by everything. And then they go back to Nazareth via Jerusalem, where the child is ritually blessed at the temple. They go off to Nazareth. And after I'd read the two accounts, I thought, what an amazing disparity there was between them. I mean, they don't agree on anything at all. And how is this explained by the theologians? And theologians traditionally tend to say that obviously there are two different sources for the two accounts, and the sources are probably on one hand Mary and on the other hand Joseph. But when you think about what that means, you can't help but feel that
typical husband and wife.
Well, I mean, they couldn't remember which decade the child had been born in. They weren't sure whether they'd gone to Egypt, after the birth, or back to Nazareth, which didn't exist. It's not probable. So, there are other things going on, and without going into too much detail, there are enormously interesting other things going on, and the fact that we're specifically told that the only gospel used by the Essenes, and the Jews at this period were divided into three major groups: Sadducees, Pharisees, and Essenes. And the Sadducees and Pharisees were really varying levels of fairly sort of status quo Orthodox Jews who followed to whom the law was really the guiding principle. But by this time, the law had been so subdivided into queries, which start when you say, well, thou shalt not kill, but what if somebody's coming in and chopping up my family? Does that mean I shouldn't kill them? And so on. It's all whittled down. And in fact, when you read about the acts of Jesus, you see that quite overtly a lot of them are designed to confront Jewish law. But the Essenes, you know, who are the most misunderstood group because they really chose to place themselves in that position, you know, were not male renunciants. They weren't reclusive monks. They quite distinctly were married, but they did abide by extremely strict rules, which involved the certain periods of the year when they would be secluded in the community and where they would assume sort of different roles to the ones they assumed in society. So that Joseph, you know, who we're told is a direct descendant of King David, who, you know, clearly was not a carpenter, or a pauper in real life. He was a carpenter while he was within the community, because everyone had to have a function that was simple and that reminded them of, you know, their essential humility, and mm-hmm. you know, that it was good to do physical work. So, you know, he's a carpenter in that sense, and, you know, his son is in that sense. And, you know, there are many other things, many other aspects of Essene life that really shed light on what we're told in the Gospels, you know, including the virgin birth.
And so you're confirming, and I've heard this a bit around, that that Joseph and Mary were members of the Essenes.
They're quite clearly members of the Essenes, but what goes on thereafter is an indication what the Jesus movement stood for was not entirely in agreement with a lot of the Essene policies.
And we'll come right back and tell more of this story. Paul William Roberts is here to do it. In Search of the Birth of Jesus is his book, The Real Journey of the Magi. I'm Laura Lee. Boy, there's so many directions in which we can go, and I do want to take some phone calls here tonight. I know our listeners will have many, many questions for you. But I want to know, tell us a little bit about your journeys as you began to research all of this in the libraries. That's just one aspect of your journey. You were preparing yourself for an inner journey as well. And then you took the actual physical journey where you went to these places and you searched for some of the anchoring pieces, artifacts mentioned in Marco Polo's version of the nativity story in his book, so that you could begin to then anchor it. Well, if you got this part right, then maybe the other parts were right, was your logic, I guess. Tell us a little bit about the actual journey there and what you hoped to find, what you did find, and what it meant.
Yeah, let me just finish with a few pieces of context.
Please do that.
You know, after, and a lot of what I was doing was concomitant with the liberation of the Dead Sea Scrolls from the control they'd been under, and when the Huntingdon Library obtained the full-scale plate photographs, we started getting a lot more translations. The process has been unusually slow. It had taken 50 years, and you know, we hadn't got even anywhere near half of the scrolls. But so as I'm working on this, I'm also in touch with the people who are working on the scrolls, and it confirmed a lot of things that I felt somewhat intuitively were going on, particularly the connections between Zoroastrianism, Judaism, and Christianity. And on the other hand, at the other end of the research, I'm thinking, well, you know, how do some magi become three kings with names? And you find that there's a period where these people who are present at the nativity range in number anywhere from 2 to 14. And the whole process only solidifies, really, with the Emperor Justinian, who ordered these mosaics to be installed in the Basilica in Ravenna, which show quite distinctly three kings, kingly figures of three different ages, and for the first time they're named as Balthazar, Gaspar, Melchior. And that's where that all comes from. But there's a good 600 years in between the two events. And in fact, the period that interests me most and that is ultimately most mysterious is the first 300 years of Christianity, where you go from the life of Christ to the arrival of what really is a very small Jewish sect, suddenly turns into the state religion of the Holy Roman Empire. And by the time that happens in the 3rd century, when the Emperor Constantine allegedly converts, there are 300 years that are almost missing. All the texts that we have, the earliest manuscripts we have of the Gospels are from the 3rd century. And even from looking at those, the two oldest Gospels, for example, the two oldest versions of the Bible, Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus, in the oldest of the Gospels, the earliest of the Gospels, St. Mark, in both manuscripts, the last 12 verses are missing, and the last 12 verses of St. Mark contain the resurrection. So immediately, you're thrown into, a whole kind of can of worms, theological can of worms. And then on the other hand, as I began to travel through Iran and found in Sava, first of all, the structure that Polo describes as the tomb quite precisely, at the other end of town, because the whole city of Sava had moved gradually north, in fact, wisely so, because it's quite windy down at the other end. There was a ruined mosque with a minaret, which turned out to be actually one of the earliest minarets in the world. And within the mosque itself, at the lowest level, you could see it had originally been a Zoroastrian temple, or a fire shrine.
What were the marks that made it so?
They're very simple. I mean, the Zoroastrian religion really didn't so much forbid as disapprove of building temples. What they liked were simple shrines in beautiful natural surroundings. Let God build the temple, we'll build the little shrine. And only symbolic things were offered to the fire. But the notion of sacrifice is limited to a little milk and offering of this flower, herb, soma.
We'll come right back with Paul William Roberts. I'm Laura Lee. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. We're talking with Paul William Roberts. He's telling us about his research. It's contained in his book, In Search of the Birth of Jesus, The Real Journey of the Magi. Also, I want to mention that Paul was just thanking me during that break for the amount of time that we are giving this interview and generally our guests and their research to lay it out in full. And this really is the purpose of the show. This is why the show is 5 hours. It's why it's once a week, because I need to do a lot of research as well. And this is why the show exists, so that we can give researchers like Rick Levine, who's been on the show many, many times, at length, like Paul William Roberts, because these people are doing cutting-edge research. It's involved, it's extensive, and it's fascinating, and we want to give them a chance. And only radio can do this. You can't really do this on television. Only this medium can offer this kind of interaction and length and in-depth interview. Now, Paul, you're telling us about your actual journey to Iran, which used to be Persia, and looking for some of these hallmarks. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to try and cut to the chase. I should also add that I actually refused to do television for that very reason, with the exception that we are planning to do a 6-hour documentary series with Walt Disney, Walt Disney Television. Which gives you enough time, but otherwise I won't do television because 10 minutes is ludicrous. to try and sort of put this in a nutshell, which is difficult, the end result of what I discovered is that the debt owed by Judaism stroke Christianity to Zoroastrianism is so immense that I would even go further now than I do in the book, and it would say that by the time of King Solomon, Judaism had almost collapsed and disappeared, and that during the period of the captivity, when the Jews were taken to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar, this period really resurrected the religion, because by the time of Solomon, you have a religion which is in scholarly terms, really henotheistic, not monotheistic. In other words, it's a tribal deity. The god that Solomon is talking to is not the creator of the universe. This entity is worried about Solomon going across the road to some other god and getting a better deal. And we're told, finally, Solomon's reign is really an unmitigated disaster, but the bad news is put off for as long as possible by the writers of the scripture. But finally we're told, but Solomon loved many strange women, and indeed he did. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines.
Well, no wonder he couldn't rule a kingdom.
Well, I mean, it must have been all he could do.
A little distracted.
And we're also told that they were all these wives and concubines were allowed to worship, you know, in their own manner. And we also are told that he built a temple for his prime wife, who we know was the daughter of the Egyptian pharaoh, right opposite the one he supposedly built for his own god, which alone must have infuriated that god. But by the end of his reign, the kingdom is divided into two. He's oppressed the people. The curious thing is that, you know, he's known as Wise King Solomon, and the one account of him being wise is actually deeply perplexing. The two women come, two prostitutes, in fact, who've given birth to two children, one of whom has died, and both claim the one that is alive as their own. And Solomon says, well, cut the baby in half. And one woman says, no, don't. And the other woman says, yes, cut him in half, we'll have half each. And
so we know who the mother is.
Most people think that Solomon gives the child to the woman who says, no, don't cut him in half. In fact, you know, if you read it, that isn't the case. It's almost as if we're being told, you know, this, he isn't wise. You know, it's as if the word wise is being used sarcastically. Because to any writer of Jewish scripture, a king who oppressed his people, divided his kingdom, betrayed his God, could hardly be described as wise. So something else is going on. In fact, I plan to do a book on Solomon. But the whole issue really starts here with the building of the temple. And I'm now fairly assured in saying that Solomon did not build a temple. You know, no trace of it has ever been found. The oldest structure there is the palace of David and Solomon, and the palace of Solomon sort of added to it. But the oldest part of the temple is the Second Temple. And during the period of the Second Temple, you have two major figures involved, besides the fact that the Persian emperor Darius is financing this project. And in the texts, all of the texts, no matter, you know, where they come from, whether they come from Persia or whether they're Old Testament texts, always refer to the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the building of the temple. It's not the rebuilding of the temple. And by the descriptions of the temple in the books that deal with that, the remains of the temple should have been so considerable, certainly the works that were cast in bronze, they would not have been able to disappear. Something would have remained, but nothing is there. And you have two figures, this character Zorobabel, which is obviously a name quite close to Zoroaster, and very un-Jewish in form. And his sort of priestly counterpart. And we're told quite distinctly by one of the prophets that the ideal rule was considered to be a balance between that of priest and prince, with the priest being the former of two equals. And Zerubbabel is the princely messiah, and a figure called Joshua is the priestly or Zadokite messiah. And the prince was supposed to be descended from David, and the priest descended from David's high priest Zadok. So you have this concept of two messiahs. And in traditional Judaism, the word messiah is not so loaded as it is in as become in Christianity. It merely means Mashiach, means the anointed, which in Greek, Christos, is the same thing, the anointed. When Solomon is anointed king, he's anointed Messiah too. And what you have during the time of the Second Temple is the curious disappearance, you can only assume death, of Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel, who is the governor in charge of, he's the de facto king, but he clearly works for the Persian emperor, and he simply disappears. When the temple is inaugurated, the one person you'd expect to find there, Zerubbabel, is not there. He's never mentioned again, and there's a sort of substitution of, where you'd expect to find Zerubbabel, you find Joshua, and it's acknowledged by most, by all scholars of Hebrew scripture that this is a sort of inspired substitution, because quite clearly something happened to Zerubbabel. And you find that during the time of Jesus, which is the time of the third temple being built or added to or rebuilt by Herod, a similar situation, that you have, instead of Zerubbabel, who is mentioned in the genealogies as a direct descendant of Jesus, you have Jesus and John the Baptist. And Jesus is quite clearly the princely Messiah, and John the Baptist is quite clearly the Zadokite. So when he baptizes Jesus in the River Jordan, in the beginning of the two Gospels of Mark and John, you have the beginning of the ministry. And in fact, Jesus does not preach until John is dead. So you have a parallel situation to the situation you had at the time of the Second Temple, where it's parallel but reversed. The prince dies, and the Zadok, or priest, tries to hold the whole situation together and fails.
I didn't know that so much was known about that period. Jesus. You always hear that they can barely prove the existence of Jesus as a historical person. And yet it seems like you've been able to detail so much of what happened then. Where are you finding all this stuff?
The Dead Sea Scrolls are a rich mine, but...
and those are only recently available.
Standard texts, what you find is in Josephus, for example, where you'd expect to find quite a lot about Jesus. A lot of people say that Josephus never mentions Jesus. In fact, he does mention Jesus, but only in the context of the death of James. And James is one of the brothers of Jesus, and it seems to be the older brother.
And you hardly ever hear that Jesus had brothers.
Well, he had at least two sisters, and probably about four or five brothers. And again, it's quite clearly mentioned in one of the most reliable Gospels, Mark. The very first time we hear of Jesus, he's preaching, and some people say, what on earth is going on here? Is not that Jesus who, whose brothers we know, and the brothers are mentioned, and whose sisters are, right now in the synagogue? Where does he get off preaching? I mean, there seems to be some question about why he suddenly started to do this.
We'll come right back with Paul William Roberts. I'm Laura Lee. There is quite a bit of research that Paul has done. For context, he's also taken a journey to retrace the steps of Marco Polo and that journey of the Magi. Quite fascinating. Paul, go ahead.
But in a nutshell, what you have is really only explained by the historical documents of the time, and particularly in the Dead Sea Scrolls, where increasingly we see that what was the reason the church was so anxious about these documents becoming becoming sort of published
and
widespread, is that they quite clearly show that the that Essene Judaism really is Christianity in many of its rituals, but that Jesus was not a strictly Orthodox Essene Jew, because he is quite clearly contradicting some of their really strongly held beliefs on many occasions. So you have a sort of spin-off Essene sect, but also you must examine the the situation in occupied Judea at that time. And the real issue involved in the book is, who were the Magi? Why did why were they at the Nativity? Why does this story exist? And all this is tied up with a relationship between Persia and the Essene community, which is all detailed in the book.
How'd you describe that relationship between Zoroastrians
The thing is that the priestly caste, both of Persia, and if you see Zoroaster as essentially distilling the Vedic religion, which by this time, by Zoroaster's time, which is 1000 BC, was becoming Hinduism, which was becoming increasingly complicated with moving from a non-dualistic concept of God, where there really only is one thing in the universe, which to me seems a fairly correct view of things, to the sudden proliferation of 36 million gods and goddesses. But when you think about it, monotheism, which creates the duality that is man and God, is just as misleading in many ways. And the oldest texts we have, the Vedas, and this is one area of scholarship I was involved in, is Sanskrit, and I can quite clearly see that in the writings we're left from Zoroaster, that what he's attempting to do is provide a more palatable version of the most ancient religion that we know on the earth.
Which is
the Vedic religion, which became Hinduism, although still exists in India in its pure form. And part of that entails an understanding of the nature of good and evil, which has been quite lost in the West, where the church essentially created a devil who, rather than being a sort of adjunct of God, it becomes an opponent of God. Well, if there's only one creator, then that creator created evil. There's a snake in the Garden of Eden, so paradise is not so paradisical or utopian. Why is the snake there? Why is evil there? But the way it became transformed by the church was that the devil was almost a sort of counterpart of God with his own rival kingdom, where you went if you weren't good. Well, that's not true. That just as darkness is not the opposite of light, it's the absence of light. And by its presence, by the presence of darkness, we perceive light. All these things which are now presented as somewhat ominous and apocalyptic come into existence. And the classic difference between Christianity and Zoroastrianism has been defined as Zoroastrianism gave the devil an infinite beginning and a finite end, and Christianity gave him a finite beginning, but an infinite end. Because in the Zoroastrian scheme of things, where the two forces gradually mix, mingle, and then are engaged in a conflict, in which time we're in, the outcome of that conflict is known in advance. That, of course, only the positive force, and they're not called good and evil, they're called truth and really not truth. So truth, of course, wins in the end, so the outcome is known. And all this is present in Christianity in its earliest form, and survives, in fact, in sects like the Cathars, up until 1000 A.D., if not beyond.
It's very interesting how many of these ideas were floating around and in various forms for a long, long time. We'll come right back with Paul William Roberts. I'm Laura Lee. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. Our guest, Paul William Roberts. Let's take the rest of your phone calls. Next, Mike in Scranton, Pennsylvania. What station are you listening to, Mike?
WHAS out of Louisville.
Oh, wonderful. Signal 840 on the AM dial and covers, I think, what, half the U.S.
Yeah.
I'm glad you found us. Go ahead.
Okay, I'd like to know where that church that Thomas founded in India is located, and is that commandment, thou shalt not kill, a mistranslation of thou shalt not murder?
To the last one, yes. I mean, you're probably right, but when you look at the range of mistranslations, well, let's deal with India first. There are, in fact, seven churches that were founded by Thomas, and they're all in what is now the province or state of Kerala, which is the extreme southwestern state, quite large state, which still contains also one of the oldest synagogues in the world and a Jewish community that's been there for 3,000 years, since probably before the time of Solomon, which explains why Thomas was probably headed in that direction. And there was a period where the both Jews and Christians seem to have been regarded by the local king and regarded each other as one and the same thing. And I strongly contend that there is no difference between Judaism and Christianity at this level. And the only real disagreement that exists is over the divinity of Jesus. And if you accept that God is not sort of something that can be confined to a human body, although a human body can contain God. What's the difference between the droplet of water that hits the ocean and the ocean at that level? To discuss the other question, this whole notion of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, as opposed to vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, they really are garbled versions of a teaching that's quite clearly saying, don't worry about what other people have done, and that they shouldn't get away with it, because nobody gets away with anything if you accept that the only reasonable law that could govern a universe would be that whatever you do comes back to you. And if you fully believe that and accepted that, you'd be incapable of doing any harm to anyone. And I really, really believe that until this becomes once again a fundamental principle of all human existence, that we can't expect to move ahead that much. And people become too preoccupied with what everyone else is doing. Just worry about what you're doing, and the rest will take care of itself. And I think that message is quite strongly there. Yeah, I mean, these debates about thou shalt not kill, the Hebrew word, it's true, is murder, but whether it contains a definition of excluding self-defense. Everyone knows the difference between good and not good. And people who don't know are in fact insane, serial killers and so on. These people are delusion has reached such a state that they're in fact not functioning on any level at all properly. But we all know what's right or wrong. And of course, there are times when when stealing is clearly right if your children are starving to death, and you steal food from someone who's got too much, you know, I don't think you're doing wrong. But again, I mean, you can't legislate anything like this. You know, your conscience dictates these things, and you know, a mother's conscience as you know, as a father's conscience in the context of somebody trying to attack his family, you know, they dictate that. And the message really is that. But you know, try putting it on paper. I mean, you know, there's nothing that we can't make more complicated. That's why Jesus says, Moses gave you 10, let me try again. You know, here's another one. Treat people, you know, the way you'd like to be treated.
Even that old adage, what you do comes back at you, even is reflected in the philosophy of Native Americans, who felt like every action should be weighed as to its effect for 7 generations. The idea that our actions have repercussions that extend through time, like ripples on a pond. And if you believe in reincarnation, you'll be there in the future to receive its adverse effect or its benefits too.
Yeah, I mean, it all be. I mean, you can see that. I mean, in the Vedic and the Eastern teachings, you know, where you know the mind is quite clearly identified as our enemy, that you know, because there's nothing the mind can't start taking apart. You know, when you say, yes, you know, whatever you do, you know, we'll just you know travel around the earth and come back and you know hit you or kiss you in the back of the head. Mm-hmm. You know, then there's always someone who's going to have his hand up and say, well, what about this? You know, the hair splitting goes on and on and on. And
it's also a matter of physics, really, because as my first program director told me, he said, just think this interesting fact when you're on the radio that everything that you say is being broadcast into space and you are setting up radio waves and sound waves that will continue radiating out through space for eternity until it bumps into something and is stopped. I mean, you know, so even us speaking on the radio tonight are setting up waves that are going to go out through the universe and have an effect, not much of an effect, but an effect. I mean, it's everything that you do sets up waves through a universe, which is a sea of waves, as quantum physics tells us. So I think this is a matter of science as well as a moral teaching.
No, and in fact, you know, one wonders that you know, perhaps everything would have been better expressed in terms of number, because you really can't argue between the relationships between numbers. And Pythagoras does say on a number of occasions, you know, it's all number. And in fact, you know, the ladder of the sciences, the thing Lecomte devised, mathematics is the base, and then you know, physics is derived from mathematics, chemistry from physics, biology.
This was once an ancient science that was lost and is now being rediscovered through the advent of modern technology today, and
well,
computers and all the tools that we have, and I think that's so fascinating.
The only people who dare venture into the realm of metaphysics from physics are, in fact, the physicists.
Listen to all of the great physicists, and even Einstein, they're very metaphysical. Paul, I just want to thank you so much for the visit tonight and for taking us on an adventure. I must say that if it's not uncharted territory and if it weren't a little controversial, it wouldn't be an adventure. Well, we certainly went on an adventure tonight.
Well,
I want to thank you all for
so
joining
much.
Us. And talk to you next week. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com